Walmart says it is not telling its employees how to vote. But some of Walmart's employees begged to differ and said so last week to the Wall Street Journal. The employees objected to meetings being held with department heads and supervisors of Walmart to discuss politics and the policies that the Walmart bosses said would hurt the retail giant. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, August the 8th. And we had several listeners suggest that we do a program on this story to try to figure out what Walmart is up to. And we found a great guest to do that. Daniel Gross is the senior editor at Newsweek and author of the Moneybox column at Slate.com. His piece on Walmart, entitled Retail Politics, is online both at Newsweek.com and Slate.com. And he joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So what is Walmart up to?
Well, you know, Walmart has, I think, a kind of strange and slightly confused take on its participation in the political sphere. On the one hand, the thing it seems to fear most, the thing it seems will be most damaging to its business, to its stock, to its future, is the prospect of unions coming to Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is bitterly opposed to a piece of legislation called the Employee Free Choice Act that, you know, Congress is looking at that would certainly make it easier for people to unionize. And it claims that these meetings it's been having with supervisors, managers, et cetera, has been to sort of inform them about that piece of legislation, how that piece of legislation will make their jobs more difficult to manage people, et cetera. And, of course, the, you know, unspoken or, in some cases, spoken assumption is that, you know, this is a piece of legislation that the Democrats in Congress are for, that Obama would sign were he to be elected president, that McCain would not sign. And so it you know, quickly comes down to, you know, if we want to stop this thing which we most fear, we can't let the Democrats control the levers of power. And I heard, since writing my piece, you know, several Walmart employees responded, you know, wishing to maintain their anonymity and saying, well, even though Walmart, after the Wall Street Journal article, said, you know, in no way did we say you should vote one way or the other, we were just talking about this piece of legislation, the employees who reached out to me were saying, you know, of course, you know, we're not stupid. Of course they were telling us that, you know, an Obama presidency would be a threat to us and that therefore that's, you know, we should not be voting that way.
Yeah,
and the reason I say it's strangely conflicted and confused is because of another trend that has surfaced in their political participation, which is this. In the past, Walmart's Political Action Committee gave the overwhelming majority of its donations to people running for Congress to Republicans. In 2000, it was like 85-14. And, of course, Republicans control Congress. Now, you know, to pass a law, it requires the people in the House and the Senate to pass it, and hence, you know, you would presume Democratic majorities.
Mm-hmm.
As well as a president. So you would think that if they were so bitterly opposed, that if this piece of legislation was so potentially damaging, that they would be doing everything in their power to keep Democrats from controlling Congress. But, of course, in this campaign cycle, you know, reflecting the reality that Democrats now run things on the Hill, their political donations have been actually evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. And so they have donated to people like Charles Rangel of New York, you know, big friend of labor. You look down their list of people who've received money from them. They've donated to plenty of Democrats who are friendly to labor and who favor this piece of legislation that Walmart so bitterly opposes. Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of schizophrenia going on here.
They're hedging their bets?
Yes, I think, you know, they have come, you know, for years, Walmart was content to be this, you know, it's sort of aw shucks, down-home, Midwestern, Southwestern image. You know, Sam Walton riding around Arkansas in his pickup truck. They were, you know, based in Bentonville, Arkansas. Their strategy was to expand throughout the, you know, rural areas and the plains and the south, et cetera. And for the first couple decades of their growth, they had this, you know, explosive growth. No one really paid much attention to them, and they weren't really much of a fixture on the Washington scene. They didn't have a political action committee. They weren't big lobbyists. They didn't feel a need to tell their story. They didn't really seek to influence policy because they were just doing what, you know, they were establishing these big stores in out-of-the-way places and taking giant market share and being very profitable. It's more in recent years when, A, its size made it a lightning rod for everything from, you know, low wages to lack of health insurance to imports from China, and B, as it tried to get more into urban areas and suburban areas where they encountered political resistance, zoning issues, et cetera, that they've had to become more engaged in politics at the state, local, and federal level. So there's been kind of a disconnect between their size as a company, they're the biggest retailer in the world, and their presence in Washington as a player. They've kind of come late to that, and I think as a result, they're still sort of feeling their way, trying to figure out, you know, what works, what doesn't work.
We're talking with Daniel Gross. He's a senior editor at Newsweek, and we are talking about his piece on Walmart, Retail Politics, Walmart's Campaign to Influence the Election, that is posted online at both Newsweek.com and Slate.com. And we welcome your reactions and questions for him. Is Walmart afraid of a Democratic administration in Congress? Is the company trying to influence its employees to vote Republican? Walmart says no. The employees say yes. And we wonder what you say. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Is there anything wrong with this anyway? We'll talk more about that after the weather. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, August the 8th. Hoping you'll stay tuned. Coming up, it's our Friday Week in Review. Coming up after 8, we'll have the latest from the presidential race, including a poll here in Wisconsin. Obama leading McCain, but that lead narrowing. We'll talk about that and other political news of the week coming up after 8 o'clock. Right now, we're talking about politics and Walmart with Daniel Gross, who wrote a piece on this. He is the senior editor at Newsweek and author of the Money Box column at Slate.com. We welcome your questions for him. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk at WPR.org. And Daniel, before we go to the phones, you also say that Walmart is not only giving money to Democratic candidates, which might seem surprising to some, but it's also or has been involved in registering people to vote, and that might surprise some people too.
Right. Well, back, you know, in the recent years, Walmart has really been working on its image for, you know, to try to kind of get some of the political heat off of it, but also to appeal to more, you know, upscale, yuppie consumers. It's going into new areas. So, you know, it's going green. It's building these environmentally friendly demonstration stores, et cetera. And one of the things it did as part of this effort to improve its image was mount a voter registration campaign. This was back in 2006, where they said they were going to, you know, educate employees about registration process, give them sort of time off, make it easier for them to do so. And of course, there was some suspicion, maybe they're going to try to tell people how to vote. But when you look at the breakdown of Walmart's employees, you realize that, you know, statistics being statistics, in effect, they would be encouraging people to register who are more likely than not to vote Democratic. And what I mean is this: their employees are mostly on the lower end of the income scale, which is a constituency that votes Democratic. They are disproportionately women. 75% of the sales employees, 60% of their employees overall are women. We know that in recent years, generally women as a group have voted for Democrats by a pretty large majority. It is disproportionately African American, about 17 or 18%. versus 8 or 9% in the population at large. And we all know that African Americans vote overwhelmingly for Democrats, and the same holds for Hispanics as well. So when you look at Walmart's workforce, about 1.3 million associates, you know, this is a sort of portrait of the historic Democratic coalition. You have women, minorities, and low-income people. So to the extent that their efforts bore fruit, that they encouraged people to register to vote who may otherwise not have registered to vote, you know, a statistician would tell you, or a demographer would tell you, that in effect they might have helped bring you know, substantial numbers of Democrats or potential Democrats into the political process.
Yeah. So do you contend that Walmart is just confused?
I think so. I don't think it's so much confused. I think it's a question of, you know, I think the thing about Walmart and with so many companies is that they are, you know, the things they know how to do, they are brilliant at, right? They know how to manage logistics, manage supply chains, find the cheapest source of any product. They know how to build these stores. They know how to promote. They know how to appeal to their low-income consumer. They know how to strike deals to get exclusive supplies. They are the best in the world at that, and they have proven themselves. That's why they built this company from one store 40-something years ago into the world's biggest retailer. There are other things that they are not so good at, where they try their, you know, get outside their core competency. Their efforts to kind of bring fashion in have been a flop. Their efforts to appeal to a higher income, you know, fashion-conscious consumers have been a flop. You know, their efforts to kind of go green have been successful as far as a money-saving effort, but not in terms of improving its image to the point where, you know, a lot of consumers are flocking there as a result. So when they get outside their core competency, as is the case with so many other companies, they kind of stumble. They're not the best in the world at gauging what the political environment is, at, you know, negotiating the political process. It's something that it takes you a long time to learn how to do, and they hire, you know, they hire sort of consultants who hold themselves out to be experts on these things. And, you know, maybe these consultants who are telling them what to do and advising them on how to, you know, improve their image, on how to play the game in Washington, et cetera, you know, maybe they're not the world's best at what they do. So I think it's maybe less confusion. It's just that, you know, any time a company steps outside its core, it's likely to stumble, and because Walmart is so big and everything it does attracts so much attention, you know, it seems clumsy at times.
To the phones we go, and we do have an open line for you and time for you before a news break. If you would like to weigh in on this story about Walmart allegedly trying to influence its employees to vote Republican, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have a line open for you. David in Boulder Junction joins us first. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. First of all, kudos to Walmart for encouraging their associates to register to vote. I think we'd have the same reaction if it was Whole Foods or The Gap or Microsoft or anyone else. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. I think it's... you know, we don't vote in the numbers we should, and, you know, it's pretty easy to register, but I guess a lot of people feel that there are obstacles. So to the extent that employers can make it easy and encourage them to do so, I think that is great. I think the, you know, the danger, of course, is the potential to cross the line. And it may not necessarily be something, you know, from the headquarters on down saying, you know, this is what you say. It could just be like a store manager, and you could get this at any company, and of handing out the registration form and then the person saying, oh, by the way, you know, if you know what's good for you, you know, or just because that manager or supervisor may have strong opinions of their own on either side,
right,
you know, telling people or advising people so that people feel pressure not just to vote but to register for a certain party or vote in a certain way. And this happens, you know, from the low end of the income scale, i.e. Walmart, to the high end. There's a I think a piece in the Wall Street Journal.
Can I jump in here for just a second, then you can go on to a different caller?
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, David.
The reason I called, the comment that I wanted to make was that I think it's a non-story. And the reason it's a non-story is because we know that it happens all the time, and we know why it happens. And, you know, there's no secret. It's to gain influence. It doesn't bother me that it's a retail company as much as it would bother me if it was my children's teachers union telling their teachers how to vote, or if it was my firemen and my policemen getting told how to vote. Now, whether they're told or whether they're this or that or it's sent out in a memo, you know, we all cover our tracks, but we all know that that happens all the time. Everybody's looking for influence, and we're looking for any advantage that we can get in our particular sector that we're working in.
Yeah, so
David,
I just want to make sure I'm clear on this. So you don't think there's nothing wrong with Walmart holding these meetings with supervisors and managers to talk about the policies that a Obama presidency might bring and how bad that would be?
Well, when we know what the associates at Walmart make, and I doubt that their managers make that much more than they do, I think it's a question of wanting to have a job 6 months or 12 months from now. And, you know, is it wrong to take people back in the back room and have a meeting? I don't know, but there are favorable policies that will make it easier for them to do business than another administration may have for them.
Yeah, Daniel, and that's what this is all about.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the issue is not so much the sort of speech aspect of sort of saying, we think you should do this. The issue is more of whether there are consequences for people who don't go along. And, you know, with voting, obviously we have a secret ballot, so it's hard for an employer to know that, you know, to say, did you vote a certain way and then fire somebody. But there was a story in the Journal, I believe, about a guy who worked at a consulting firm and was told by his boss to donate to the Romney campaign, presidential campaign, because they thought it would be good for their business, because, you know, they would get in good with some of the other fundraisers at financial firms, and by everybody participating and giving money to Romney, it would be good for their business. And one of the guys refused because he didn't particularly like him, and he's now claiming that he was fired because of that refusal. The employer is saying that, you know, there were performance issues, et cetera. But, you know, the slippery slope, I think, comes not so much in saying, you know, we all know there are so many businesses and jobs where government policy does affect what they do. An oil company, energy company of any kind, insurance, et cetera, you name it. And as he gave the example of the teacher union as well. So, you know, the notion, it would be naive to think that people wouldn't say, hey, if this guy's elected, you know, our business could benefit or suffer, and then draw the line. It's quite another to therefore say that the private behavior of the employees, somehow they get punished for going, you know, for not going along.
I need to jump in because we have news from National Public Radio coming up in just a moment, and then we will talk more with Daniel Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, talking about his piece on Walmart and politics. Retail politics. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him. We'll get to more of your calls after the news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. That's the title song from Walmartopia. That's a play, a comedy produced by, written by two Madison playwrights that is now on or off Broadway, or at least it had an off-Broadway run. It's about Walmart taking over the world. We're talking about Walmart during this hour with Daniel Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, author of the Money Box column at Slate.com. His piece on Walmart, Retail Politics, is posted online at both Newsweek.com and Slate.com. We're talking about Walmart and politics because last week the Wall Street Journal ran a story about Walmart allegedly trying to influence the vote of its employees, holding meetings with department heads and managers to try to scare them away from an Obama presidency. Walmart denies that it did anything wrong, and we are talking about that and other things Walmart is doing involving politics. Wondering if you think there's anything wrong with what Walmart is up to. What is Walmart up to? We welcome your questions. We had a number of listeners who wanted us to do something on this particular story, so following through on that listener suggestion, did receive an email from Karen in Lafayette County. Do note that Walmart is not the only company concerned about this upcoming labor union legislation. Many companies are already starting to have seminars to instruct their management people on what they can and can't say about possible union organization. We have heard about Walmart because they are such a big company, but they are not alone. Daniel Gross, is that right?
Absolutely. I think it's, you know, anything Walmart does becomes a metaphor. It's a story in and of itself. It's what, you know, AT&T was back in the 70s and 80s, what GM was in the 50s and the 60s. It's the biggest biggest American company, biggest retailer by sales, the biggest employer. And, you know, so it's got a big target on its back. There are teams of reporters who are devoted to just covering what Walmart does. So, you know, anything, any trend that is going on, you know, Walmart is not the only one doing it. Walmart was not the only company importing retail goods from China. It's not the only company that was kind of lagging in not giving health benefits to people. But because it was so large, so visible, so massive, it just gets, you know, anything it does gets magnified, and people like to use it as a sort of metaphor case study. You know, you put Walmart in a headline, it's going to get a lot of attention.
Yeah. And the Employee Free Choice Act is a legislation that has a very good chance of making it through Congress and being signed into law by President Obama. Is that a sure thing if Democrats are in power?
Well, here again, I think there's a, you know, I think business and companies frequently have a very simplistic view of how Washington works and how the two parties, you know, feel about certain issues. If you take the issue of free trade, where I think most business people and companies think there's a very stark divide, you know, Republicans are for it, Democrats oppose it. And you look back at recent history, you know, NAFTA was passed into law mm-hmm. with a Democratic president and at a time when Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, which would not have, you know, been what the predictions would have been. More recently, in 2002, when President Bush had a Republican Congress, a Republican in the White House, he enacted steel tariffs, which is something we would have never thought that group of legislators would have done. So, you know, the politics of these labor and trade issues are never as simple as they seem. And then you get all sorts of complicating factors. The Republicans have more than 40 votes in the Senate. They can filibuster a piece of legislation. So, mm-hmm. you know, we've seen all sorts of stuff that the Democrats controlling the House and the Senate have been unable to pass. In addition, you know, the Democratic Party is certainly more aligned with unions than Republicans. But if you look at how things have changed over time, it's not the way it used to be. Private sector unions only represent about, I think, 8% of the workforce. They're a much smaller force than they used to be nationally. You have a lot of Democrats who were elected from districts in the South, in urban areas, in sort of yuppie suburban areas, where those congresspeople are not particularly beholden to labor unions. So, you know, this sense that the labor movement has this kind of ironclad grip on the Democratic Party is not, you know, it's just not historically accurate, and it's particularly not accurate today.
Yeah, let's take some more calls. Maury in Hanover, Illinois. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm calling specifically on the notion that perhaps Walmart might be a bit confused or feeling their way or inept politically. I would remind everyone that they've convinced the American people of rather a lot of nonsense over the years with their advertising, and they can be awfully cynical in their public relations campaigns. I was the director of a social service agency in central Illinois about 20 years ago when Walmart came in, and they managed to, they did a little public polling. Well, what would you like to have that you don't have now? Recycling came up. We didn't have a recycling program. So they immediately set up a very nice divided bin in the Walmart parking lot where people like myself would dutifully go out every Saturday morning and separate their aluminum and their glass and their plastic and their paper. And then come Monday, they would come along, pick it up, take it out the landfill, and dump it. And I think that's just, you know, these are the same people who said they'd never sell anything that wasn't made in this country. I don't think they're inept politically, but what they are doing is spreading the tentacles on both sides of the aisle. And the parties are not terribly ideological or principled anymore. And I think it's just a matter of spreading it out and corporatizing the politics further in Washington.
Yeah. Any comment, Daniel Gross?
I think there's something to what he's saying. I just think having covered politics in Washington for a while and writing a lot about the links between business and politics, there are some industries and companies that kind of know how to play Washington like a fiddle, that are very subtle, sophisticated, and nuanced about how they approach it. And I think we've seen a pattern of really big companies that are sort of not, you know, they grow up outside the sector. We saw the same thing with Microsoft in the 90s, right? In the beginning of the 80s, Microsoft was nothing. It was a blip. It was out there in Seattle. It was doing a business that was not regulated at all. Never foresaw a need to have a Washington operation. All of a sudden, you know, it becomes this giant company. It's having antitrust issues. It's being prosecuted. And they wake up one morning and say, oh, no, we got to do something about this. We have to have a Washington presence. And because they have the resources they do, you know, they don't come in with an office of one or two people. They come in sort of with heavy armor. And I think inevitably that attracts attention. It is a kind of disjuncture that people notice. And again, because they, you know, the people who run the company are themselves not veterans of this process, they rely a lot on outsiders, many of who I think are, you know, are just not, they're sort of better salespeople than they are operatives. So I take all the points that the caller make, but I still think there's something to this because we've seen it before with big companies that grow up outside that have nothing to do with Washington and then suddenly realize, okay, we have to become a player in public policy, and inevitably there is a certain level of kind of clumsiness that enters the narrative.
Thanks to Maury for the call. We'll take more of your calls after this quick weather break. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Cute shirts, huh?
We got them at Walmart. Under $8. Seriously.
They're made with cotton, and get this, recycled Coke bottles.
Like, plastic bottles helped make these shirts.
But here's the really cool thing.
If every Walmart shopper, all 200 million of us, bought one, it'd be like recycling over 500 million plastic bottles.
That's a lot of bottles.
And one fabulous fashion statement.
Budget-friendly prices. Earth-friendly products. Save money. Live better. Walmart.
And that's an example of Walmart's ad campaign saying, you know, it's a green company. And Daniel Gross, that's an example of Walmart trying to clean up its image.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Dennis in Rhinelander is with us. Hi, Dennis. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to just recall a show that you had approximately 2 years ago about Walmart and other big retailers not shouldering their burden with state taxpayers having to pay for the health insurance through Badger Care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that time the state was paying approximately $3 to $4 million per year for Walmart employees. And at the same time, Forbes had put out a survey or a statement of the wealthiest Americans. And at that time, approximately around there, 5 of the 11 richest people in America were in the Walton family. And I believe that the nexus to the question we're talking about today or discussing is that Walmart has decided that they do not want to share the efforts of the whatever they make with the company's great profits with their workers. And they perceive that if the workers are allowed to unionize, they may be able to come and ask for a little bit more of the pie for themselves. And I think that that is something that we should all be concerned with, because the effect of Walmart has been to effectively go throughout the nation and eliminate production jobs, because the companies that are in America cannot compete with a lot of Central American countries, yeah. China and India, when it comes to the standard of living that we want middle-class Americans to have.
Yeah. And Daniel,
I think that's something that's very of great concern to us.
Well, you addressed this in your piece, Daniel Gross.
Yeah, I think, you know, Walmart has always had this very zero-sum approach to employees and employee compensation. They pay the absolute bare minimum they can get away with, that paying them more would somehow be a threat to their business model. And the great irony, of course, is that, and they've supported policies at the national level and generally candidates who have been sympathetic to that. The thing I point out in my column is that, you know, Walmart is really focused on who's in power and, you know, Republican versus a Democrat, and how one is going to be good and one is going to be bad. But when you look at the ultimate measure of how the company is doing, which is its stock price, it's exactly the opposite. You know, in the 1990s, when Clinton was the president and Democrats controlled Congress for a portion of the time, their stock more than tripled. And the reason was that, for whatever reason, and I think economic policy had something to do with it, the economic expansion of the 90s created new jobs for all people and saw incomes rise at every level, which means that the kind of people who shop at Walmart, who are also the kind of people who work at Walmart, had more money to spend, and so their business was able to expand, they were able to be profitable. Mm-hmm. What we've seen this decade, since President Bush was inaugurated, Walmart stock has not done anything for, you know, going on 8 years. It's had almost zero return. And the reason is because, a variety of reasons, its growth has come to a halt, but, you know, its sales haven't been increasing because the people who shop there, the people who make below the median income, their incomes have not been rising this decade at all. The economic policies put into place by the Republicans have not helped them at all. And, of course, there are other issues having to do with global trade and globalization and all this that explain why, you know, working people have not done particularly well this decade, but I think economic policy has something to do with it. And the end result is that, you know, they're not able to be as profitable as they were in the past. And so, you know, my point is that what they should really worry about at the sort of macro level is not these issues about, you know, a lot of their fears about the unions and this piece of legislation are kind of misplaced, because in this decade, Walmart has there's been an administration and a regime in Washington that's very hostile to labor, but it hasn't done any good for Walmart stockholders, right? Their company has not seen its stock rise at all in 7 years. I think they should be focused on a sort of bigger picture issue, which is, okay, what is the, you know, most of their business is in the U.S. Their business prospects depend on the ability of lower-income Americans to spend and to buy. So what are the policies that are likely to improve the prospects? When you see the price, you know, wages, median income has not risen in this country for 7 years. The number of people without health insurance has risen. Energy prices, I mean, all of that is taking away the consuming power of Walmart's customer base. So I think they'd be better served asking themselves the question, which party or which candidates has the policies that are most likely to benefit our customers? Because they always say, in their defense, we're just an agent for our customers. We go out and we buy the cheapest goods we can, mm-hmm. and we give them the cheapest price because we're acting on behalf of our customers. Our ability to profit rests solely on that. That's their whole self-identity and business model. Mm-hmm. And I think they need to be asking themselves not so much which party is going to pass a piece of legislation that they think might help them vis-a-vis labor unions, but rather which party is going to pass legislation that is going to create a climate in which Walmart's customers prosper.
Yeah.
I think looking at the record of the last you know, 16 years, it's clear what the case has been.
Yeah. Thanks to Dennis for the call. Sue in Duluth joins us now. Hi, Sue.
Oh, hello. I'm sorry. I have a bit of a cold. Another example of Walmart cynicism, as it has to do with public relations, is that they were getting a lot of bad press because so many of their employees have to use public medical care and public-funded social services of various kinds. And so in response to that, they instituted a policy where everybody, including part-timers, all their employees, are eligible for their health plan. And they really touted that a lot in the press. It was just a breakthrough, especially for part-timers. The problem was that it was so expensive and their pay is so low that they ended up, it didn't really affect Walmart employees' use of public services. They could not afford their own health plan, whatever the monthly payment was.
Yeah, I get it. Our last caller brought that up too, Daniel Gross, about so many being on Medicare or Medicaid programs.
They have expanded, as your caller noted, they have expanded the access to health care plans. And, you know, again, I haven't looked at the numbers that they've provided. I would guess that there has been some increase in the number of employees who are, you know, taking that up. But, you know, what frequently happens in these cases is that the policies that are offered are pretty bare bones, so that if you're basically healthy, you know, no worries, it's a great deal. But if something happens and you get sick, they have very high deductibles, they have limits, et cetera, so that in the end it doesn't necessarily do all that good.
Yeah. Is Obama's health care plan something Walmart is afraid of?
Well, it's interesting. I've been writing for several years, and you start to hear it here and there. But, you know, the biggest beneficiaries of national health care would actually be corporate America.
Right, that's what I think, yeah.
Right? Because it would be taken out of their hands. They always say, you look at the GMs of the world, they have these huge health care costs because they, you know, made these, they went to the unions. The union said, you know, we'll take the health care instead of wage increases. And they said, okay, thinking they could control it. Now it's a huge burden for them. And, you know, the companies that do provide health care are, of course, at a competitive disadvantage to companies that don't provide health care. And so there's this tendency to skimp, to provide minimal stuff, to push the burden onto employees. And, of course, you know, that's not particularly good for morale, it's not good for retention, et cetera. You know, imagine if they just didn't have to deal with that at all, if there was some portion of the taxes they paid, or they paid a tax that was somewhat equal to the amount that they were already paying, and people had it, you know, they had insurance that they could take from job to job with them, or they had some sort of entitlement to some minimum policy, and it was something that they would not have to deal with at all. That would be a huge relief to a company like Walmart or a company like GM or actually any big employer.
Yep. Let me get in another call before we're done. Mike in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
I think Walmart's done a terrific job. They've hired a lot of people that are on borderline competence. They've built stores in places that other people are afraid to build stores. I think that basically instead of rapping on business, which is what you're doing, if you don't like Walmart, go out and build your own store.
I'm not sure we're rapping on business, but Daniel Gross, Walmart's not evil, a general comment.
Well, look, there's no question that they are a huge employer, a big taxpayer, and, of course, the customers benefit from the low prices they provide. The issue is whether, you know, that model is the best model for a business to adopt from a social perspective, but also, I would say, more importantly, from a business perspective. And again, the proof is in the pudding of the stock price. You take a look at a company like Costco, which is, you know, has warehouse shoppers, big box retailer, where they have unions represent employees. They pride themselves on paying above the minimum wage. They pride themselves on giving health care to their employees. They have much lower turnover, right? Because They don't have to hire 40% mm-hmm. of their employees every year because they leave. Walmart does. And they have a much better public image. They get sort of yuppie shoppers who come and spend a lot of money there. Their profit margins are higher, and their stock has been a much better performer than Walmart. So I think there's this sense that, you know, the Walmart model worked for many years. I think, you know, in recent years, it's if you look at the stock chart, it's shown that that model is somewhat broken. So, you know, the ultimate answer to the critics was, okay, you say Walmart should be doing this and that, they shouldn't be doing this, but, you know, business is all about returning profits to its shareholders, and they have to do the things that do that. And, you know, image, of course, is part of that. But when you look at the returns to Walmart's shareholders this decade, they've effectively been zero. So what are they gaining from this business model? Well, and then you look at some other companies that have slightly different business models that have been doing somewhat better.
We're going to have to leave it there because we're at the top of the hour. Daniel Gross, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We learned a lot.
Sure, happy to do it.
Daniel Gross is senior editor at Newsweek, author of moneybox.com at slate.com. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Cynthia Schuster and to Michelle Kofel for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.